Hello, and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known as the Stockbridge Munsee Community. I'm Lennox Aputo.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we start off with Mark Dunley reporting on the May 3rd rally, sponsored by several dozen community groups calling on banks to stop funding fossil fuel companies as a way to stop the climate chaos. Then Sina Bazila Hickey talks with Ellie Irons about the plant swap being held at the sanctuary on Saturday, May 11th. After that, Hugh Johnson joins us once again for our weekly look at climate and weather, this time focusing on the continued record-breaking monthly average global temperatures and the severe weather in various parts of the country, as well as our local forecast. Then Lavender speaks with local singer-songwriter Emily Beck about her music and current Hudson Valley tour. And we end with a piece to honor the National Awareness Day for missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports that nurses at the Albany Medical Center are pressing the state to take more drastic actions on the hospital and other healthcare providers across New York that they say are not fully complying with the state staffing standards written into law over 2 years ago.
The Board of Regents, on June 10th, will consider a broad range of changes to the education system in New York based on a report from a Blue Ribbon Commission. According to the Times Union, the commission's recommendations include stopping requiring Regents exams for graduation, changing the list of required classes in high school, and adding more real-world experiences like internships or work skills like public speaking.
The Historical Society of the Town of Colony has been able to raise $82,000 to buy the historic Anglo-Dutch farmhouse on Johnson Road that was built by a former Revolutionary War soldier and Van Rensselaer, tenant farmer in the late 18th century. This is the oldest house in the town and was under threat of being sold and demolished.
The Times Union reports that a judge has rejected motions filed by New York City and Albany officials that sought dismissal of a lawsuit filed last year by the town of Colony, alleging that the two municipalities had unlawfully converted a Wolf Road hotel into a migrant homeless shelter without following state regulations. And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can join our team, please do. Or contribute your financial support, please do that too. See the donate button at mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us 518-272-2390. We welcome your suggestions for segment topics, too.
Now to our first story. On Friday, May 3rd, Mark Dunley attended a march in downtown Albany calling on banks to stop funding the climate chaos, and brings us this report.
On Friday, May 3rd, Third Act and Rivers and Mountains Green Faith, along with several dozen climate and faith groups, held a Stop Funding Climate Chaos march in downtown Albany, targeting banks that continue to provide tens of billions of dollars in financing annually to enable fossil fuel companies to expand their operations. The march included a bagpipe player and members of the Red Rebel Brigade. The march stopped at Chase Bank, Bank of America, and TD Bank to protest their financing of fossil fuels. We hear from Michael Richardson of Third Act and Green Faith, march leader John Sequid, Leah Penniman of Soulfire Farm, Greg DiGiorgio of the International Workers of the World, and Pete Looker.
Michael Richardson, I am the co-facilitator of Third Act Upstate New York and also co-convener of Rivers and Mountains Green Faith.
Now, this is at least the second time, probably more, you've been out here pushing the banks. What type of progress is being made and what needs to happen next?
Well, actually, this is the third time in as many years, and the progress is more missed than hit, let's say. That when it comes to these big banks, Chase, Citi, Bank of America, they're only putting more money into the excavation of new fossil fuel. A few banks, some positive signs, HSBC and a few others have backed off of coal and tar sands, but they're still in the business of natural gas and oil.
So what could, you know, federal or state regulators be doing about reining in the banks and not having them promote the expansion of fossil fuel use?
Well, it wasn't so long ago that we had the Great Recession that banks were all being labeled by fiscal stress. But yet we seem to be ignoring all these, let's call them stranded assets, all these investments that's going into an industry, into a product that science and our politicians have told us need to be phased out rapidly.
So if people want more information, follow up on this, is there a website or a resource they can look at?
Yeah, I'd say one of the best places to go to is go to thirdact.org, and you can actually look at Third Act Upstate New York there or see what else is going on in your state.
Thank you, Michael.
Rally MC John Sequid outlines the fossil fuel financing of Chase Bank.
This is the bank that holds the distinction of being the dirtiest bank on planet Earth. Chase Bank has spent over $434 billion enabling the climate crisis since 2016. And again, that doesn't even include the 2023 or 2024 numbers. Among the climate destabilizing projects that Chase is helping to fund is the Carmichael Coal Project in Queensland, Australia, an open-cut coal mine with an annual production of 60 million tons of coal. Now, just keep this in mind. Last year, the water temperature off of Miami was 101 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the temperature of a hot tub. What a great idea. Let's burn some more coal. Closer to home, Chase is a major funder of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. That's a 303-mile gas pipeline from northwestern West Virginia to southern Virginia, and the 73-mile Southgate extension of the Mountain Valley Pipeline that goes to North Carolina. Both of these projects have faced intense community resistance, but Chase doesn't care. They don't care who they hurt or whose lives they disrupt, as long as they can turn a short-term profit. Profits over people. Immoral. We'll now hear from Ia Ifabagmila Leah Peniman, African traditional priest and co-founder of Soul Fire Farm, one of the co-sponsors of today's action.
When I was living in Ghana, West Africa, where I began my clerical training in 2000, I lived amongst the people of Odumasi Krobo in a remote rural area with no running water, no transportation, and no electricity. Nene Zogli, the chief of that village, kept notches in the post of his house of the date of the first rainfall after the dry season each year. Seems that this date is getting later and later every year. And so much so that the maize and cassava that we have cultivated for millennia no longer ripens and comes to its fullness within the period of time when the rains are falling. Our people are hungry. Fast forward to having my own farm, now over 20 years later, the rains are not falling in their time. We have drought, we have flooding, we have mild winters and pest outbreaks. We have early blooming of our orchard followed by a late season frost that destroys the apples. Our people are hungry here that we feed in Albany, New York, this neighborhood, this area of food apartheid. And it affects the ability of farmers to feed our community. And I tell you these stories because climate chaos is a human rights issue. And the people who are most vulnerable to climate change are often the very same people who are most vulnerable to police violence, to hunger, to poverty, to imperialism and militarism. It's our Inuit siblings in the Arctic who are losing their food source. It's the farm workers who die disproportionately of heat stroke. It's our elders. It's our family on the islands, facing the complete obliteration of their communities as the sea expands. And we are here because we see an interconnectedness between all of these issues. We stand for the climate as a human rights issue. We stand for Palestine. We stand for Sudan. We stand for Haiti. We stand for the people of this neighborhood who are under the onerous oppression of poverty and miseducation. These issues are all connected.
Greg Giorgio, upstate New York, regional membership branch of the IWW, Industrial Workers of the World. I'm a delegate with the union, and I also serve on a couple of committees, including its organizing committee. We are here today to represent the voice of workers who have long been ignored in struggles for environmental protection and for sustainability. We realize that excesses of capitalism have not only exploited workers to many degrees, but have also exploited the resources of the earth to the point where we're threatening our own existence. And if workers cannot become more of a significant part of the decision-making process and how things are created, how things are distributed, and how things are sold, then we'll never be able to get ahead of the crisis that is looming on the near horizon.
So much of today's protest seems to be focused on the role the banks are playing in finance and the continued expansion of fossil fuels. How can we rein in the banks?
We need to rein in the banks by continuing the pressure with actions like we're doing today. There are going to have to be consumer actions that put pressure on the consumption of fossil fuels. And we need to, as the working class needs to stand up and say, we won't work in these industries anymore unless certain conditions are met. And so by combining those things, we'll make some progress in the near future.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Pete Looker, I'm in the third act of life, and I'm hoping to not leave too bad of a mess for our next generation.
And what's your feeling about these banks? Why are you protesting the banks today?
Oh, they're so stupid and dirty. I mean, to build a new pipeline and build a new fossil fuel-rich plant is just, like, idiotic in today's world. It's like, that's not the wave of the future, and they're just investing in destruction of the climate.
And I see you got a couple of signs and T-shirts. One is Dirty Bank, but the other one is a Ceasefire Now. How do you connect those two issues?
Unfortunately, it's the same banks that are funding the war machine, and they're funding the climate destruction machine. Citibank, Bank of America, they're killing people, and they're killing the climate.
And so we're walking up the street towards the state capitol. How are our state lawmakers doing this year on climate? And are there things you'd like to see them do?
I'd like them to take big steps rather than the mini, mini steps they've been taking. Little steps are nice, but big steps are better.
Any big steps in particular?
No, kind of doing away with stupid plastic would be a good step in the right direction. And the HEAT Act and doing... shifting over very quickly.
Thank you very much, Pete Looker.
This has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thanks to Mark for that report. For more information, visit thirdact.org.
Next, we share information on how to get plants for your home or garden. Sina talks with Ellie Irons about the plant swap at the Sanctuary's College City Growers coming up this Saturday, May 11th.
The annual Collard City Growers Plant Swap is taking place this Saturday, May 11th from 12 to 2 p.m. And I'm excited to have Ellie Irons with me in the studio to talk a little bit more about what to expect and the upcoming season in the garden. Welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, pleased to be back and so excited we've gotten to plant swap season.
Yeah, I feel like many people get very excited about plants. There's been a boom since, I would say, maybe COVID. Mm-hmm. I'm more of an indoor plant person. I think you are more of an outdoor plant person. And it's for both of us.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, you'll be able to bring plants and take plants away. And it's all free. That's the spirit of Plant Swap, is you can bring cuttings from your house plants that you'd like to share with the community. You can also bring any seedlings you've started that you don't think you're going to be able to use. You can dig up chunks of stuff from your garden that's easy to separate and just bring them in pails and buckets, and folks show up with all manner and types of plants. And then We usually will offer some from the garden as well, and you can take some away with you as well. You don't have to bring plants to take plants necessarily, so feel free to come as you are.
Maybe some listeners haven't been to Collard City Growers. What makes this garden model unique from other garden models? What are the base principles of Collard City Growers?
Sure. So Collard City Growers has been running for more than a decade now, and it has been shaped by the fact that it started out as a double-wide vacant lot that had been buildings and has been building gradually into a kind of permaculture-style garden, meaning, you know, there's lots of different ways to think about that term, but that it's plants that are perennial, meaning they live from year to year rather than an annual crop that, like, dies back each year. We do have annuals as well, but we have a lot of, like, fruit trees and vines and other plants that produce year after year without needing to be replanted. So it means there's like a little lower maintenance in some ways or a different kind of maintenance. And it also forms more of an ecosystem is the idea rather than a garden that you churn up each year and plant new plants. We also do have annual beds. So we'll grow, we grow collards, Collard City Growers, and other greens. We have herbs. We just started our sugar snap and snow peas, so we have that kind of thing happening in the garden as well. But we really look at it as like a both biologically and culturally diverse space because we're interested in having foods and medicines and plants that will serve the widest array of our public as possible, which includes humans and non-humans as well.
Gardens can sometimes feel intimidating to enter into, or the medicinal properties of plants is something that I had to learn it, for example. Can you talk about how anybody can come in and it's a way to learn about the medicinal properties and the permaculture models of the garden, but everyone can come in as you are no matter the level of knowledge in the plant world?
Totally, yeah. We like this to be a space that is welcoming for education. We don't think about it, and we're getting educated by the space ourselves all the time by what the plants want to do. So I'll include the plants and the land as the educators. But for those of us who've worked in the garden for a long time and have learned from it, we like to have the garden serve that purpose for other folks. So when you walk in, you may see, whoa, there's so much greenery here, and I don't necessarily know my way around. We're doing our best to you know, have food get produced, but to have it be a place where people are able to learn what it's like to harvest a collard green or snap a pea, or learn the difference between a garlic plant and a blade of grass, which at this time of year look kind of similar. We're actually working a lot right now. One of our projects is legibility in the garden. I mean, it always has been, but you'll notice.
Yeah, a whole bunch of signs have popped up.
If you come to the garden, all the beds are labeled now. This has been an ongoing project, and we hope to have a big map up soon that will kind of allow you to map what's in each bed to the map and kind of get a better sense of like what is growing in each bed, because it can be overwhelming, but we also love to just walk through the garden with people and pluck things and eat them and smell things. So you can go on a smell and eating tour of the garden with someone who knows their way through it, and it's really fun.
Yeah, it's a real reprieve from the asphalt jungle around it, especially, you know, all the senses. Those right now the lilacs are out, which we don't have lilacs in the garden, but like
right down the street.
Totally right there. Parents have been talking about ways to get their kids involved around here, and there will be opportunities this summer with the open garden hours. Isn't that right?
That's right. Yeah. So the plant swap is kind of our official opening of the season. We've certainly been in the garden plenty before, but the plant swap marks are opening. And then every Friday after that, we're going to be in the garden from 3:30 to 5:30 p.m. And every third Friday is going to be a community work and play day where we're going to provide activities that are family oriented for, it can be for adults, for kids and adults, or, you know, just to get people in the garden working, but also doing some family-friendly, kid-friendly education. So the garden will be open every Friday, but will be specially geared up to make it an educational experience on third Fridays.
And it is quite attractive for the young people. There have been, you have kids, a lot of the other people who are involved in the garden have kids. So it is a really beautiful way to blend these different social circles of these children as they are, you know, learning their social way around the world.
Totally. I mean, I think this programming comes out of having observed the way the kids have interacted in the garden over, you know, previous seasons and wanting to really be able to formalize some of that a little bit, but then also continue with the kind of organic play that we really love seeing in the garden also.
All right. So this Saturday is the plant swap from 12 to 2. Visitors will be able to meet some of the Nature Lab staff and the sanctuary staff. As we mentioned, I'll be bringing some houseplants. I've got these succulents that need some new homes. I'm more of an indoor plant person because I don't have an outdoor garden other than coming to Collard City Growers. Other people have the space and have these wonderful gardens. What have previous plant swaps looked like?
Oh, goodness. So it's an organic event in that it, you know, it takes ARC over a couple of hours, and there's these waves of arrivals of plants. So you might show up at the beginning and be like, oh, there's no tomatoes. And then the tomatoes are going to show up at like 1:30. So we invite you to like find a way to kind of hang out in the garden and maybe take a tour around campus. You can go walk up to Freedom Square and see the fruit trees in bloom. You can walk down to the Nature Lab yard and take a peek at our new watering can sculpture. There's a lot of fun stuff on campus right now. So, yeah, I think it really is a kind of luck of the draw, what shows up at what time. I'm planning to dig up some of my ostrich ferns from my backyard because I've got a very shady backyard and they're doing well. And then I think I said earlier, you know, we can always dig up things from the garden that divide well. So we'll usually, you know, send people away with anise hyssop. We've got raspberries. We've got a lot of different herbs that can be easily divided. So,
yeah, those plant starters, we always make more starters than we can. This is a great time to kind of share and swap. And this year, last year was kind of marked by a frost that came in right after the bloom was starting, which it was a bit of a damper to some of the fruit trees and all of that. What does the garden look like this year in the growing cycle?
Well, it does look like, despite that ice storm that we had, like our fruit trees have come through okay. So it looks like we're going to have cherries and peaches this year, which we were really sad not to have last year. We had like 5 cherries, I think, like I count them on one hand. So that's looking really good. We've got asparagus. We've got overwintered kale right now that's been delicious because it was like, I think it has to do with the mild winter. I'm assuming I've talked to other folks around town who have delicious overwintered kale right now. Our garlic is looking great. That'll come out of the ground in July. And yeah, the beginnings of all the berries that are kind of come into season later. Right now you can harvest mint and sorrel, and rhubarb is just coming. There's a range of beautiful stuff happening in the garden. Some stuff's still flowering. Some of the fruit trees, a little bit of flowering left, kind of past that season.
Wonderful. Listeners can learn more at our website, mediasanctuary.org. You can also just drop in from 12 to 2 this Saturday. Ellie Irons, thank you so much for speaking with me. Is there anything that you'd like our listeners to know about Collard City Growers or the Plant Swap?
Well, we are volunteer run at Collard City Growers, except for a few paid folks, and we love to have you in the garden. So even if those Friday afternoons don't work for you, please get in touch with me. And you can, you know, we can find another time when we can meet up in the garden and enjoy its abundance.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a great garden, and it's called a plant swap, but you can come and get plants without bringing any to contribute or just drop off plants.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Lennox Saputo.
And I'm Bria Barthel. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
And now we get our weekly weather update with retired National Weather Service meteorologist Hugh Johnson. Welcome back, Hugh.
Hey, how you doing, Bria?
I'm doing great, especially with this nice weather we got after a pretty nasty Sunday. So I heard something that April was the warmest ever in recorded history across the globe. Is that true?
That's true, Bria. Not only is that true, but we've had 11 months now in a row that we have broken the warmest record for that month. Like starting back in June of last year, every single month has been above normal, has been the warmest ever recorded.
And that's,
now, that doesn't grab your attention, I don't know what will.
And that's global, right? Not just locally.
Global. Well, global. No, locally we haven't had a record. We haven't had a record warm month, but the globe has, yes.
And we also heard that there has been a rash of not only severe weather across the world, across the lower plains of Texas, but lots of tornadoes. What's with that?
Yeah, well, that could actually be the beginning of our El Nino pattern. We kind of are exiting the El Nino pattern, but the La Nina. We're getting into a La Nina because when you start seeing these kind of outbreaks in the lower plains towards Texas, that's usually a signal that the La Nina pattern is starting to take place, where you get a strong southern jet, at least briefly, digging trough that can produce these tornadoes. And it's, unfortunately, it's unfolding right now as we speak. Oklahoma and Kansas, we call it dry line, where dew points ahead of it are near 70. They drop to the 30s behind it with very strong westerly winds. And when those two air masses collide, we're seeing some really powerful tornadoes starting to spin up, a couple of already tornado warnings. And this is all going to move from western to eastern Oklahoma in the next few hours. It's going to be a long night for those people. And then at the same time, there's going to be flooding. Houston had a big flood over the weekend. Nothing like Harvey. Harvey was their worst. But I got to tell you about Houston. They're the most vulnerable city for flooding in the whole country. They got over 6 million people. They're the fourth or fifth biggest metropolitan area in the country. And with climate change, we're just going to see this more and more. They might be getting more flooding tonight. It's just been really – it's all quiet along the eastern, the northeastern front after yesterday's raw weather. So we're actually benefiting, at least briefly, from a quiet, pleasant night while the plains are getting trashed. And, again, climate change, we're going to see more and more of this stuff with more powerful systems, more moisture to work with, and right down the line. But by the way, been over 600 tornadoes – nearly 600 tornadoes this year, 373 in April alone, not as much as 2011 – which was a La Nina year, but it's still a very, very, it's doubled what is normal for the 30-year norm. And also, let's not forget our folks in Colorado, the Front Range. They woke up to winds gusting over to near hurricane force this morning, and even with bright sunshine. So they had dangerously high winds much of the day, a Chinook coming off the plane. This is all from the same system that unfortunately will be affecting us, but not in these ways. We will not get the severe weather or wind that these people got, but we will get more rain, unfortunately.
And speaking of the global effect of climate change, the flooding isn't just in Houston and here, but Lennox is from Kenya. And Lennox, I understand they've had terrible flooding there.
Oh, yeah. It's been devastating back home. So for the last 2 weeks, we've had a series of flash floods that have been set off by extremely record-breaking rainfall that led to the flooding and the overflowing of dams. And depending on what part of the country you're from, especially the central and the western and the eastern parts of the country, they've been absolutely devastated by flash floods. And I think right now we're talking about over 150 people that have been unfortunately killed by the floods.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, we're just going to see more and more of this extreme. I mean, as we are still pouring CO2 into the atmosphere, and there's really no sign it's going to change anytime soon. So this is not good news. And it's also, I know there's been a lot of rain in Spain. I follow a Facebook group, the Camino. You can walk along the Camino to the Santiago. It's a spiritual thing, but they've been talking about all kinds of rain there, and it's been going into other countries, into Germany and so forth. So, yeah, it's just been a ton of rain, and guess what? We're going to be in for a bunch more rain, too, where we had nearly an inch. We had basically an inch on Sunday. Boy, that was a raw day, but we got more rain coming, unfortunately.
Yeah, so let's focus in on this week's weather locally. So you said rain. How long and how much?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it looks like another couple inches of rain, at least, which won't be as bad as places like in Africa and Houston. But we've got the same system, like I say, that one that's giving all the problems in the plains is going to come here. We're on the cool side of it, so we're going to get rain. We might get some thunderstorms. You might wake up to some thunderstorms on Wednesday. Tomorrow, let's start with tomorrow. Tomorrow's the day to get out and enjoy, do your yard work. It's going to be the day of the week. It's going to be a perfect day. 70s, lots of sunshine. So that's the day to do it, because on Tuesday night, early Wednesday morning, we might wake up to some thunderstorms, and then we'll get possibly another round late in the day. And then we got a nor'easter type rain developing Thursday and Friday. We're in cutoff low season, which means we're going to have lows that kind of cut off from the jet stream. And this happens, this is pretty typical in May, unfortunately. And when these happen, they kind of meander, and that's going to meander through the weekend. Tulip Festival. With any luck at all, we might luck out on Saturday and not get much rain at all, but Sunday looks like we'll get more showers. So unsettled week for the next rest of the week after tomorrow. So relish tomorrow. That will be the weather pick of the week.
So with all the rain, but also the 70s temperatures, what do you think? Is it safe to plant outdoors, or should we still hold off?
I think in Albany South, you're fine. I really do. If you're up north towards Lake George, the Adirondacks, wait a little bit. It could be a couple of cool nights still coming. But I really think from Albany South, we're going to be in good shape. I don't see any of us getting down to the mid-30s anytime soon. On the other hand, I don't see any real heat waves. If you're worried about, like, I'm going to try to get my air conditioned service, I have to wait till May 28th. But it's probably going to work okay. But doesn't look like any big heat anytime soon. In fact, temperatures will run a little bit below normal, it looks like, for this week. Tomorrow would be the exception. We'll probably be a little bit above normal, but after that, cooler than normal.
So we've talked about La Nina and El Nino, and I think you mentioned it earlier, but when will the total effects of La Nina kick in?
Probably later this summer, but I say we're already starting to see signals of it happening, and we're getting the ridge in the southeast. We're getting some pretty good outbreaks of severe weather, including tornadoes in the southern plains, and that's a signal that's La Nina. The jet stream structure is starting to set up that allows for this to happen, and that ridge in the southeast, and again, it looks like it's going to be a hot, miserable summer in the southeast. We're up and we'll probably be warmer than normal, but again, it depends on where the front stall. We can end up with a very wet summer. Maybe I think the beginning of summer will be wet, and then it will get progressively drier, but we'll see how that goes.
I mean, and Hugh, you also, I mean, so in addition to tornadoes and, very heavy downpour, what other effects result from collision of jet streams? Or...
Yeah, well, collision of air masses. I mean, what's happening in the plains is that we got this thing called a dry front, which is the air is not necessarily cooler behind it, but it's a lot drier, so it's denser. And a lot of times these dry fronts are where it focuses the really severe weather in the plain states. It's not the cold front. You get some more weather behind that, but the real damaging stuff usually goes along that dry line. That's exactly what's happening tonight. We're seeing dew points crashing from 70 in eastern Oklahoma to the 30s. As you get into western Oklahoma, and that line's going to progress further east as the night wears on, and rough weather will probably continue well past dark across that area, unfortunately.
So it sounds like there's a lot of complexity in all of this. Do meteorologists kid each other about when you get it right or when you get it wrong?
Oh, yeah, we always kid ourselves, and of course we always hear the public saying, well, how does it feel of a job where you're only right half the time or whatever? I mean, I've heard that many times in my career. So, you know, it's tough. I mean, but, you know, I mean, I think look at the forecast this weekend. They nailed Sunday. I mean, it was said for days it was going to be a crappy day. And I mean, it was pretty nasty, wasn't it? 50s, raw, low 50s, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Hugh, for joining us once again. And we look forward to talking with you next week.
My pleasure. Have a great week, everyone. Stay dry and enjoy tomorrow.
Always fun talking with you. And next, we highlight local musician Emily Beck about her music and current Hudson Valley tour. She spoke with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Lavender.
I'm speaking with Emily Beck, a local singer-songwriter who is currently on tour in upstate New York, and she's here to tell us about her tour and her artistry. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So firstly, how would you describe your style? What is your genre of music?
Yeah, generally I call it urban folk music. It can also be put under the singer-songwriter title. It's just me playing the guitar, and I have a lot of original music, and some of the influences for the original music come from folk and the singer-songwriter. There's also influence of jazz and funk and different things like that, which is why I kind of call it urban folk, because it's not totally in that folk box, but yeah.
Cool. So you'll be playing at the Troy Farmers Market on July 6th, correct?
Yeah.
Will you be there the entire day?
I will be. I think it's 9 to 2 or something. I'm going to be there the whole day, so it'll be fun. Yeah.
Gotcha. And will you be playing all original music, or
I'll be mixing
play covers?
Yeah, I'll be mixing in some covers too. I'll definitely play a lot of my original music, and then I'll mix in covers throughout the day too, since it's a longer period of time. I'll probably mix in some jazz, some folk, some Joni, you know, and then maybe some newer stuff. But yeah, it'd be cool.
Cool. Now you said it's just you and your guitar. I see a piano behind you. Do you also play piano?
Yeah, not really. I kind of do. I'm currently in grad school for music therapy, so I have to kind of know how to play the piano as well. But I'm definitely not as proficient on the piano as guitar. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. So what other cities are you hitting on your tour?
Well, I am going to be mostly around the upstate area throughout the summer so far, unless something changes. But I'll be in Hudson, I'll be in Windham, Kingston, Middletown. I'll be in the city as well for a few performances by Lake Mayopec, New Paltz, Cold Spring. So right around all in that area, like in the New York area at the moment.
Gotcha. So those are a little bit souther than Troy. Mm-hmm. So what brought you up to the Capital Region in Troy?
Yeah, I've been to Troy, you know, I've been to the Albany area, just because it's all really not too far. But I played this farmer's market last season I played a couple times, and I just really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the people, and it was the largest farmer's market I've ever been involved in, and I just found it so fun to interact with people for, you know, that whole span of time in the morning and seeing all the local markets. And yeah, I just found it really fun. So I wanted to come back this season as well and just be a part of the experience again.
Cool. So in addition to playing live, you've also released some music. Do you record it yourself?
Yeah, I just released a song actually last Friday, which was really exciting.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's called Resilient, and it's out on all streaming platforms. For that song, it's kind of been all over the place. I've recorded at a bunch of different studios, but usually I will go into a studio to record. It's just a little bit easier for me. This last song, I recorded some little bits and pieces on my own, but then I brought it in with the rest of the bulk of the recording, and they helped me mix it and put it together. So yeah, usually it's a collaborative effort to get the song actually on the streaming.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a musician myself, so I know exactly what you mean. So when did you start writing music?
I started writing music a while ago. I was actually thinking about this before, because I always forget, like, but I started playing the guitar in 2009, which is like 15 years ago, in high school. Before that, I was playing the violin, like as a kid in the orchestras and all of that. And then I kind of stumbled upon a guitar, found it in my house, and started playing, and there happened to be books and everything. It was like the perfect find. So I just kind of sat there and went through all the books that were there that night. And shortly after starting to play the guitar, I wanted to get more books, and then I wanted lessons. And that kind of just led into songwriting for me. So the guitar has really been a tool for me in the songwriting. And that probably started, I don't know, like 14, 13 years ago. I've been writing since then.
When you were in high school, you said?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was like a junior in high school or something when I started doing all the, like, I kind of branched out of my violin and moved on to something a little bigger and a little different. And yeah, the songwriting all happened then. Before then, I was like writing a lot of poetry and things like that, but I never really thought of it in the form of song before. So yeah.
Gotcha. But you did have that kind of musical background as a violinist. So you always had an interest in music, it seems like.
Yeah, that was why, like, when I did find the books for the guitar, I was able to just kind of like do it on my own for a little bit there. I always had an interest in music. I got gifted this like little baby violin when I was in elementary school from my aunt, which is really cool. And that I just kind of kept going and playing and enjoying that throughout, you know, grade school. So I've definitely always been interested in music. And I think over time, the different genres and, you know, have developed as I've grown. Yeah.
Cool. A couple more questions for you. You actually kind of answered this. You mentioned you're in school right now, but I was wondering, is being a musician your full-time job?
It has been at times. And right now I also have just recently moved to Manhattan, so I'm trying to, you know, figure out that transition and how to get more involved in the music scene here. So I've still been playing a lot, and I have also started teaching a little bit of music just to supplement, you know, my income. But it's been really rewarding and fun to teach. And then at the moment, I'm also in grad school, so that does take up some time. I have one more year, and then after that, I'm hoping, you know, along with just playing, I'll do a little bit of music therapy as well.
Very cool. How has it been balancing your music in school versus just kind of performing and working on your own stuff?
Yeah, it's been a challenge. I went into it naively, but that's okay. We all learn from our choices. I really wanted to be, like, actually this happened during COVID. I was seeing some of my art friends. They were, you know, doing different like paint and sip and like kind of just like these things that were involved in the community that they weren't necessarily doing before. And they were maybe virtual and then they moved in person. But I was kind of just watching people expand what they were doing rather than just like only their creations. Like, how can they be of service to other people? And I was thinking if there was anything I could do. I was like, I don't know. Is there anything more I can do with music? And I just kind of stumbled upon the idea of music therapy and helping people, you know, with challenges in their daily life through music. And I wanted to get involved with that. So that's why I ended up back in school. It's been a challenge to balance everything, but I'm playing music all day, every day, you know, at my internship, and I'm learning different instruments. And I think that all of that knowledge is really helping me, you know, in my music as well. And I've still been able to write and release music and perform. And so I've found the balance, but it is a challenge at times.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, sounds like you're playing music all day. Sounds like pretty good time.
Yeah, it's fun to me.
So where can people find out more about your tour? About where can they listen to your music?
Yeah, so they can listen to my music. I'm on all streaming platforms. So, you know, the Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, and I don't know. There were a bunch of ones that I don't really know about. So it seems to be on all of them. I just kind of clicked everything. So you should be able to find it on most streaming platforms. And then I also have a website, which is just emilybeckmusic, emilybeck.com. And I have an Instagram, which is the same thing, Emily Beck Music. I'm also on Facebook and TikTok a little bit, trying to figure that out. and then I also have a Patreon, which has kind of been a new thing. It's exciting. So you can find me on there also under the same name. So Emily Beck Music. And then I have a mailing list too. If people want to join it, they can find it on my website in the contact. They can just send me their email and be added. And they get kind of a monthly little exclusive email for people that want to be involved in that kind of intimate community.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything else you want to mention that I didn't ask?
No, I don't think so. Thank you for having me and thank you for reaching out. This has been really nice.
You can see Emily Beck at the Troy Farmers Market on July 6th, in addition to many other spots throughout the spring, summer, and fall. For more details, visit www.emilybeckmusic.com.
And now for our final segment. We honor the May 5th annual National Day of Awareness for Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women, Girls, and Two-Spirit by playing an interview from our archive with Muncie historian Heather Briegel about how land policies and legal jurisdictions relate to the problems in investigating and solving such cases.
I am Heather Briegel. I'm an enrolled citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin, first-line descendant Stockbridge Muncie, and I work as a public historian and consultant.
Welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
It's been a while since we've had you on this program, and you're now based locally, and as you mentioned, you're working as a freelance historian and consultant. So I'd love to talk about what that work is for you and what are some of the talks that you have been invited to give.
Yeah, I am local now. I'm right here in the Hudson River Valley, which is kind of cool. I think last time I spoke with you, I was still in the Midwest, and I am not there anymore. But so a lot of the work that I do revolves around public history, primarily Indigenous history, and bringing it to the forefront of everyone's mindfulness, making sure that they understand the history of Indigenous peoples. You know, I've been invited to do talks on a number of topics, whether that's, you know, well, this is very timely, but it's November, Thanksgiving. So I've been invited to do talks on how do you decolonize Thanksgiving? You know, who were the original New Yorkers in sense of like who was living in the land? I have been invited to do talks on current and contemporary Indigenous issues, such as the Indian Child Welfare Act, which I did I've done a couple of times. And the last one I did regarding that was at the Brooklyn Law School. And then also on MMIW, which is an epidemic within Indian country that, you know, not a lot of people know about outside the communities. And so we want to bring awareness to that. I've talked on boarding schools and how to create places of inclusivity. So you name it, as long as it deals with Indigenous histories, I've probably talked about it.
What are the talks that you enjoy giving most?
The talks that I enjoy giving the most deal with policy in a historical basis. So whether that is just an overview of federal Indian policy, which I do a talk on, or issues, contemporary issues today that deal with policy, that's what I absolutely love. When I was finished with my graduate school program, I had toyed around with the idea of actually going to law school because I just love policy so much. And the intricacies of federal Indian policy are interesting to delve into and try to understand because it's so different than any other type of law. Well, I did not go to law school, but my love of policy never wavered. And so I really enjoy talking about that, but from historical perspective. So how did a policy come to be? Or, for example, of the Indian Child Welfare Act, how did ICWA become a policy that was needed to protect Indigenous children? So then that leads into other topics that are in Indigenous history that combine my love of history and my love of policy all into one. So I kind of like talking about anything from a historical perspective because I feel like you have to have that historical basis in order to understand a topic.
We could spend a couple of segments just on talking about the policies that have to do with reservations. What are some of the basic things to understand about the history of there is sovereignty over these lands, but it also creates these restrictions and lack of resources? What are some of the basic things we should know about that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that people are completely surprised about when they hear me talk, and when I talk about land or reservations or anything like that, people are primarily surprised to learn that Indigenous tribes, Native Nations, however you want to classify them, don't actually own the reservation land that they're on. It's the deed, the title to that land is held in trust by the federal government. And people are, their minds are just blown when they hear that, because you think, oh, you have reservation land, oh, you must own it. No, we don't own it at all. And makes it very easy for the federal government at any time, you know, to take it away if they wanted to. But this, the idea that the deeds or titles of the land are held in trust by the federal government comes from a time period where the federal government didn't deem Indigenous peoples, Native peoples, as competent enough to handle their own affairs. So if we weren't competent enough to, quote, handle our own affairs, I'm assuming they mean, you know, Eurocentric kind of affairs, then we weren't competent enough to hold the deeds or titles to the land that we were on. So that's just, it's just a really interesting concept. So people are always like, that's just such a concept that people just, they're just mind blown by it. And they're like, so you don't own the land, so, but you live on it. So what happens when you, if you pass away, like, do you get to pass it to your children? No, it reverts back to the tribe. And I mean, sometimes it can be, depending on tribal land policies, sometimes it can be, you know, you can pass it down to a next of kin, but nobody actually owns it. So I think out of anything, that's probably the thing that people, such a misconception about the most, is that we own that land and we don't own it.
Is there linkage between the murdered and missing Indigenous women and the investigations that are taking place where if it takes place on sovereign land, these lands that are reservations, that they aren't investigated properly?
Yeah. So I think you're hinting at, are there issues within jurisdiction?
Thank you.
of who can investigate these crimes? And yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't even know where to start on answering that question, because yes, there are issues within criminal jurisdiction when it comes to investigating crimes of missing and murdered Indigenous women, whether they happen on tribal lands, non-tribal lands. Is your state a public law 280 state? Is it not a public law 280 state? Does the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, have jurisdiction over it? Does the FBI have jurisdiction over it? And what's the role of tribal police? So there is so much that goes into trying to figure out who can investigate a crime before a crime's even investigated. So once that's figured out, which can be quite difficult to figure out, there's, you know, time goes by and leads, you know, leads in criminal investigations become smaller, and perpetrators can get away. And there's also this, it's not a concept, it's an actual thing. Some of it's changing now with, you know, policies that are being passed, like, for example, under the Violence Against Women Act, some things have changed. But if a non-Native perpetrator or person commits a crime on reservation land, Indigenous land, the tribal court system doesn't have jurisdiction over them. And so it gives this idea that tribal lands are just places that you can go to commit these crimes and you can get away with it because the tribal police don't have jurisdiction over you. So you can commit a crime on tribal land, leave tribal land, And by the time the crime gets investigated, you're already long gone. So yes, there is this complicated relationship between tribal criminal justice and federal criminal justice on who can investigate said crimes and bring people to justice for them.
I think it's important here to note that even though it's only recently been gaining some more attention, this epidemic of murder and missing Indigenous women, it's been since colonization this has been happening, and it's been a long time issue. Yeah. Before I let you go, thank you so much, Heather Briegel, for joining us. What is one thing that you'd really love listeners to understand around the work that you're doing or around some of the issues that you talk about?
First and foremost, Indigenous people are still here. We might not be in the numbers that we once were prior to colonization starting, but we're still here. And we still have histories that are rich and vibrant, and stories that we want to share and issues that we want to talk about. And, you know, you can educate yourself on our histories and be open to learning something new. And so I really just want people, when they see, you know, programs happening by Indigenous artists, speakers, scholars, what have you, go to them, learn, because you're going to learn about a side of history that you didn't know before. And, you know, support Indigenous-led causes, support Indigenous-owned businesses. Like, we're getting ready to do holiday shopping, you know, support those businesses, because when you do that, you're supporting culture and tradition and language continuously happening. And that's, I think, more important than anything in the world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Sena Basilahiki speaking in November 2022 with Heather Briegel, Mansi public historian. For more information about the speaker, visit www.heatherbriegel.com. That's Heather, BRUEGL.com. Our thoughts are with all missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit, as well as their families. And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lennox Saputo.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Thanks to our engineer for this episode, Captain Kaylin McPherson, in the saddle again. And we thank all of the other folks who made today's episode possible, including Mark Dunley, Lavender, Hugh Johnson, and the ever-amazing Sena Basilahiki. This is a team effort, and you're welcome to join our team.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a Sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
We want to hear from you. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Mag, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Tune in each weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., or 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website and on your favorite podcast platform.
And thanks to you, our listeners, including our international live streamer in Kenya, for making this all worthwhile.